Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we're going to be welcoming on the phone Michael Brennenbaum. He'll be in town on Tuesday, January 29th, as part of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and a guest of the St. Cloud State University Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, also sponsored by the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. Michael Brennenbaum has an extensive resume as a writer, lecturer, historian, and former director of the U.S. Holocaust Museum. His lecture is entitled Anti-Semitism Today, Paris, Pittsburgh, and Beyond. And once again, that'll be on Tuesday, January 29th, beginning at 7 p.m. at Atwood Memorial Center's Cascade Room. Now, while the Holocaust might be a bit of a heavy topic for the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, many of the issues we struggle with these days are heavy topics. And plus, this could very well be a part of the history of your family, whether you've got Jewish heritage or a relative who served in World War II. And plus, after listening to Michael Brennenbaum, a man who has advised presidents on this topic, you might find that your perspective may have been enhanced in a thoughtful, unforeseen, and ultimately positive way. So, Michael Brennenbaum, welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. And could you give our listeners just, you know, kind of a, you've got an extensive history on this topic. Could you just give a brief rundown of, well, you know, who are you and where do you come from and what got you into this?
I was born in New York. I was actually born in New Jersey, but I was raised in New York City after the war. And I went to Jewish parochial school. My teachers were either, and I went to Hebrew-speaking Jewish parochial schools, in which we spoke a very remarkable Hebrew. One would only describe it as a Shakespearean Hebrew. So when I came to Israel many years ago for the first time, the way I asked the bus driver for directions, and imagine doing that in colloquial English, "If your heart inclineth in my direction, would you kindly indicate to me, thy humble servant, what is the proper path upon which one should go to reach his anointed destination?" Naturally, everybody laughed at me, and I didn't understand that that was not the way in which you spoke a living language. But my teachers were Holocaust survivors and refugees. They weren't yet called survivors, they were called refugees, and because they were the people who had studied in the comparable schools in Europe and were lucky to get here. They had taught us in quiet terms that we were to make up, we the generation of whipped cream and sour cream, and ice cream, the, as it were, spoiled and rich Americans, were to make up for a world that had been destroyed, but they never told us about it. They told us about words, children, camps, death, but nothing about what really happened. And I was then continued on, was at university, I was working on an interesting question in the history of religion. Why did the Jews not go out of business after destruction? Hmm. In other words, what was it about Jewish history that allowed these people to recover from a catastrophic discussion when other people who were defeated back in ancient civilization disappeared? When somebody came up to me and said, "You're not asking an ancient question, you're asking the contemporary question. You're asking the question about what happened to the Jews in the aftermath of the Holocaust." I started reading in Holocaust literature, and I realized that in a very real way, that was the question that my generation was, if not asking, was supposed to ask. And then I started studying the Holocaust. I did a doctorate and got my first university teaching assignment. And then sometimes in life, you, however smart you are, you're best off if you're lucky. And I got an opportunity to work on the President's Commission on the Holocaust way back in the Jimmy Carter era. That to some of your listeners may seem like ancient history. And I was the staff person who was assigned to staff a commission of presidential appointees who asked the question, what is an appropriate national memorial to the Holocaust? We came up with the recommendation that it be A, in Washington, B, be a museum and a living institution. And I went back to teaching and to working in academia. And then I had a second piece of luck, which is my successors in planning the museum had failed. And they had failed because they knew museums but didn't know the Holocaust. And if you have three or four failures with people planning, the problem is the first failure is their fault. The second failure may be their fault. The third failure, you begin to wonder if it's your fault. And by the fourth time, you say, I must be doing something wrong. So somebody said, why don't we reverse it? Let's take somebody who knows the Holocaust and can learn museums and bring them on board. And I then became the project director overseeing the creation of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And we got the opportunity to build this museum on adjacent to the National Mall that has now received some 40 million visitors in the first 20 years of its existence and has had a major national impact. And I got to create and to bring into words what and transmit to the American people what had been communicated to me in silence. And it was the rare opportunity of a lifetime. And then I, after the museum was opened, I realized that, I'm giving a long story, but you'll understand it. I realized that that after museums opened, it needs administrators more than creators. And I didn't want to spend my life working on, not that it's unimportant, I didn't want to spend my life working on budgets and overseeing bureaucracy and the like. So I then had the opportunity, the second fortunate opportunity of my life, to be invited by Steven Spielberg to do the Shoah Foundation, which recorded the testimony of Holocaust survivors, 52,000 testimonies in 32 countries, in 57 countries in 32 languages.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, I was given the opportunity not only to give voice to what I had heard in silence, but also then to give the people who communicated much to me in silence the opportunity to speak to the American people and to speak in a way that generations would record them. Now, to give you a sense of that significance, there are only 36 oral histories of people who were once slaves. And we have 52,000 testimonies of people who are Holocaust survivors. So this collection is enormous in scope and scale. And the question after we gathered the testimony, question of my successors has been, what do you now do? How to use it educationally? And that's fascinating. And in the last 20 years, I've been working on four different ways. I've been working to create museums that tell historical stories, to create films, mostly documentaries, but oftentimes I'm called in to help help oversee that the content of non-documentary films, even of Hollywood blockbusters, are historically correct and historically faithful. I joke that I'm the rabbi who says you can do this, you can't do that, what we say in Judaism, kosher or non-kosher, and with historical material. I teach, I write, and I create museums and films. So I've had a terrific time, and I am invited to lecture. And one of the things I enjoy is going out and speaking to various groups in diverse communities throughout, I guess, throughout the world now.
Well, there you go.
That's a synopsis. Sorry to take so long.
Oh, no, that's all right. I was looking at your bio on that, and just the first page goes on for quite a while, and it's extensive. Yeah. It's better than busy. Better be busy than bored. You definitely have not been bored. Yeah. And
I have not been bored.
And it is such an important topic. I think
I would say, in all seriousness, I would say, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is that I am a rare person who dreams that someday they will be irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean that I wish that we lived in a world in which we could say, look at how idiotic 20th century humanity was, that they could perform such evil, horrendous acts, and we could never do that. Instead, we find, sadly, tragically, that the issues of the Holocaust have not diminished in time, but virtually increased in importance in time, as we hear some of the same issues echo again and again in our world. Everything from what is our responsibility to refugees, to who do we want to count among as Americans, to what about totalitarian governments, and when is democracy imperiled, and what human freedoms must be preserved. All of the issues that are, and how do we combat genocide, and all of the issues that are current today.
I think that you really did hit on it, though, when you were talking about, you know, this question about history and how did the Jewish people come out of the Holocaust with still existing, where this has happened before within history, within the cyclical nature of history, and then those people have vanished. And, you know, we still kind of see these on a smaller scale here and there popping up, like in Rwanda and,
right,
and things like this. And, you know, then, you know, like you said, there's something happening today that is a little alarming. And, you know, that kind of moves into, you know, what you're going to be speaking about on campus. And we are speaking with Michael Brennenbaum on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota at 88.1 FM KVSC. He will be speaking on campus as part of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, sponsored by St. Cloud State University Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education, on Tuesday, January 29th at 7 p.m. in the Atwood Center's Cascade Room. And now we talk about how the topic of his lecture ties into today. When you're getting here, the actual name of the lecture is Anti-Semitism Today, Paris, Pittsburgh, and Beyond. And, you know, just with the nature of how technology is these days, how social media, the news, everything coming at us, there may be people out there that don't understand what happened in Paris and what happened in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Or they don't remember, even though it only happened not so long ago. And I think maybe that's kind of the nature of what, well, you know, like you said, you've got museums and you've got this in, well, I say you, like your organization, you've got these thousands of recordings of oral histories. And that is something that maybe can stand in front of how history just kind of gets wiped clean every once in a while.
Well, we're hoping that it does, because part of what oral history does fabulously, and, you know, is to incarnate the experience, give the abstract and make it concrete. I theologically say that the genius of Christianity was to imagine and perceive God as incarnate in the spirit of one human being, who was the Jesus figure, and consequently Jesus of Nazareth, and consequently it gave voice to and concrete expression to, and every narrative that it tells us makes it personal, and that's what gives it depth and voice and narrative.
Yeah, it also brings that human touch to it as well, because it's easy just to think of, oh, there's a group of people, and, oh, that group of people, it's not my group of people. But yet, when you're seeing a person, it's like, what are you doing to this person? Your policies affect this person, this family. These are the children that are affected by this. And, you know, then
Well, it is a curious thing because in St. Cloud, we've got a, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the St. Cloud area, but we have, central Minnesota and then Minneapolis, St. Paul as well. We've got a lot of the Somalis refugees here,
right.
The immigrants here. And it is a thing that it stresses the community a little bit, but at the same time, it's bringing something wonderful to the community because it's different. And as,
we sometimes say it stresses and it stretches the community, and precisely because it's so different, it stretches, and the community has to be prepared to stretch, and the Somalis also have to be prepared to stretch.
Yep, and that's where you get the most, I guess you could say, successful interactions between people.
That's right. I mean, that's where, and look, I'm deeply sensitive to the idea of people who are labeled as outsiders, and because, the experience I study, which is the Holocaust, had the Jews lose their status as Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And once they lost their status as Germans, that was one of the major steps toward their annihilation. Even though nobody quite contemplated it at that moment. They became the other, they became the hated other, they became the dreaded other, and they became the destructive other who's had to be eliminated. And that's an enormous danger when we other people.
Absolutely.
Instead of recognizing what they share in common. And also how much it adds to the richness of our world by experiencing diversity.
Yeah, diversity is not a threat. And I think that's something that some people do struggle with. At least that's been...
Especially not in the American experience, because America was a nation... America was established not by blood, but by an idea and by a concept of freedom. And consequently, everybody came here from somewhere, unless they're Native American. And they came here for freedom, for opportunity. They came here to escape oppression. And it's one of the great achievements of America that out of many, we created one.
Absolutely. And and now we're in a situation where somehow that is shifting. And I find
it
disturbing.
That gets us into understanding that we're undergoing a tremendous revolution in the world, and every revolution in the world leaves winners and losers, but also people who are uneasy. And the revolution is a revolution in knowledge, in scope, in scale, in mobility. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm working today with collecting material with Cambodians who are in Cambodia. So it is now 3:00 in the morning tomorrow in Cambodia, and I'm trying to work with them and get things done. And we have linguistic differences, technological differences, but I'm literally able to work in a globalized universe, which is an incredible thing. But for those who are its victims, because things are not the way they used to be, that becomes not an opportunity that is fascinating, but something that's threatening and threatening of their status.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's on that on a human scale, like an individual
right.
scale.
And then think of it as a global scale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll tell you a human story. I sat with a colleague of mine in Poland, who was a marvelous scholar. And a wonderful human being and a deep and good friend. And he said to me, and this was shortly before he died, he wasn't imagine that he was going to die, but he did shortly thereafter. He said, the oldest man, and we're sitting around his home, he said, the oldest man in my family, the oldest boy in my family, has lived in this home for the last 300 years. And none of my children will have it. When I go, I will be the last of my family to live in this home. I never imagined that I would live anywhere else. That's right. He said, well, you know, I had one kid in London, one kid in Spain, one kid in the United States. And, you know, all of them benefits of globalization, but all of them losing something unbelievable, which is the sense of stability. This is my home and this is my place.
And I think, you know, I think that really, you know, to come back to what we're talking to, that change, when things are changing, maybe we don't see them changing, even though they're happening right in front of us.
If we
look back like 30 years, we can see something. But we look back a couple of years, maybe we can see something. But when it's going on.
I'll give you one example. We now live, this is my message to students. We now live in a knowledge-based economy. The great fortunes that have been created in the last generation have been fortunes created by people who knew how to use knowledge and, in fact, knew how to enable us to use knowledge. What did Bill Gates create? Bill Gates created no product, merely a product that could unleash a product. He gave us the ability to take the power of the computer and unleash it. What did, what does Michael Bloomberg, one of the wealthiest Americans today, do? He merely puts knowledge at your fingertips in an organized fashion.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos, the same way with Amazon.
Jeff Bezos, I said it yesterday. I lived down south, precisely as malls started to come in. That changed the landscape of the downtown, down of the southern town, in which people did not shop downtown, but they shopped out in the malls with great parking and closer to suburban homes. Those malls are now being replaced by, and the difference is, in one you had to walk, in another, you had to, you could stroll indoors, et cetera, et cetera. And now you don't have to walk. You can do all your shopping from in your underwear from your computer at home. So we now live in a new generation in which the malls have been replaced by Jeff Bezos and Amazon.
It's like the world is just getting smaller, kind of.
World's getting smaller. World's getting more powerful. Mm-hmm. And more connected at the same time. The lesson I teach my students is the most important thing you can do in school is not to learn anything, but to learn how to learn and to have the confidence that you can learn, because we're all going to be working in fields and with tools that don't exist at this moment. I'm working in a computer. I work with a cell phone. I work with a fax machine is antiquated, and the like. But I work with tools that my father's generation didn't have, couldn't have imagined.
Absolutely. So anti-Semitism, this is something that has not gone away with the change of history. Yes.
Well, it's morphed. My hypothesis essentially, which I'm going to tell the audience, let me begin by saying that there was a great Jewish quipster who said the easiest way to get booed by a Jewish audience, said it 50 years ago, the easiest way to get booed by a Jewish audience is tell them that anti-Semitism is not as large a problem as they think it is. Mm-hmm. I don't argue that anti-Semitism is not as large a problem as you think it is. I argue it's a different problem. Meaning that there are probably less anti-Semites today than there have been in generations, and less institutional support for anti-Semitism, with one exception. But the problem is that we live in a world in which if you hate, you feel no restraint in the expression of hatred. And consequently, we hear more expression of anti-Semitism, along with other hatreds, than we have ever heard in the last 50 years. And it has a megaphone that is given to it by the internet. And it also has a community that's established because of social media. And consequently, it begins to have reinforcements in a way it never had reinforcements, because for a very long period of time there was a social stigma in expressing either anti-Semitism or racism, and that consequently people self-censored. That's no longer happening. And they get reinforcement for those expressions, and that's one of the reasons that we all believe, A, that anti-Semitism is on the rise, and the most important thing we can do to combat anti-Semitism is not so much to fight all of the elements of anti-Semitism, but to struggle to create a world in which hatred is no longer an acceptable to express. And that is generalized hatred, and we see all sorts of hatreds that people feel unconstrained in expressing.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. So how do we go about combating that? What would we do?
Number one, we teach people that a combination of not only tolerance, but mutual respect. Tolerance means we put up with something. Mutual respect means that our world is greater and better because it has more diversity and more interaction between it. Secondly, go back to the most fundamental of all values, which is human beings are the most fundamental of American values. We say all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We don't say, and we've included that for the last century now, we've included in our understanding that means women, but we don't say all Americans. We say all human beings. And consequently, the innate sense of the dignity of the individual, plus respect for the diversity of humanity and therefore its collectivity. And in a mundane way, I had a friend who used to say that spice is the variety of life. That change and the interaction is what brings flavor to the world, flavor to food, flavor to the world. And I think that we have to perceive that and understand that and ultimately celebrate it. Now, the good news, let me say one piece of good news after Pittsburgh. And the good news after Pittsburgh was that the civil community held. In other words, the greatness of America was manifested not in the murderer, but in the fact that in the aftermath of the murder, the city came together. The mayor was there, the police chief was there, the community rallied forth. People, the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Pittsburgh Penguins put on Jewish stars and said that this is part of our community. Mrs. Rogers came out to protect her neighborhood, which is that they came from Squirrel Hill, and this is Mr. Rogers' heralded neighborhood with all of its incredible values. And we saw an expression of the fact that in the aftermath of hate, we should never allow the triumph of hate, but rather the joining together of all the people who don't hate. And consequently, the sense that an attack on one is an attack on all.
And we've been speaking with Michael Brennenbaum here on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Brennenbaum will be the guest of the St. Cloud State University Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education as part of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day on Tuesday, January 29th at 7 p.m. in the Atwood Center's Cascade Room. It's free and open to the public, and for links to more information on anti-Semitism today, Paris, Pittsburgh, and beyond with Michael Brennenbaum, you can find links on our website at kvsc.org under the Area Events tab, or under the page for this story, under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab, and the link for this story. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.